Hey, good afternoon. Transcription is the first step in gene expression. It is also the step at which most regulation of gene expression occurs. The molecular machine that carries out the transcription process is RNA polymerase. RNA polymerase is conserved in all living organisms, thus the cellular RNA polymerases of bacteria, the cellular RNA polymerases of archaea, and eukaryotic nuclear RNA polymerases 1, 2, and 3 are members of a conserved protein family, termed the multi-subunit RNA polymerase family. Members of this protein family contain 5 conserved polypeptide subunits, termed beta, let's actually say beta prime, beta, alpha 1, alpha 2, and omega in the case of the bacterial enzyme. The bacterial enzyme consists only of the 5 conserved polypeptide subunits. The archaeal eukaryotic RNA polymerases contain counterparts of the 5 conserved subunits, but also contain additional polypeptides, typically much smaller polypeptides that are not critical for catalytic function, but are important for stability of the enzyme and for regulation. Since the bacterial enzyme is the smallest member of this family and by far the best characterized member of this family, it is an excellent model system for structural and mechanistic studies of transcription, and it will be the focus of the remainder of this presentation. A major advance in our understanding of RNA polymerase came in 1999 with the determination of a three-dimensional structure of RNA polymerase by crystallographic methods by Seth Darst and his colleagues at the Rockefeller. This shows the crystallographic structure of RNA polymerase from bacteria. The molecule has overall dimensions of about 15 nanometers by 10 nanometers and has a shape reminiscent of a crab claw with two prominent pincer-like projections surrounding a central cleft. This cleft, although it may not be clear from this view, extends deep toward the center of the molecule. The cleft has a diameter of about 25 angstroms, which is a diameter that can accommodate a double-stranded nucleic acid. The cleft also contains the active center, including the critical metal ions of the active center deep at its base. Thus, this cleft between the two pincers constitutes the active center cleft and part of the binding site for double-stranded nucleic acid within the enzyme. The conserved largest subunit, beta prime, makes up one of the two pincers, as well as part of the base of the cleft and active center. The conserved second largest subunit, beta, makes up the other pincer, as well as part of the base of the cleft and active center. The alpha 1 and alpha 2 subunits lie distal to the cleft. In bacteria, alpha 1 and alpha 2 have identical sequences, but they occupy different locations within the assembly of RNA polymerase and carry out different functions. In archaea and eukaryotes, two distinct paralogs occupy these two positions. Alpha 1 and alpha 2 in bacteria each consists of two domains, a large N-terminal domain that carries determinants for interaction with the remainder of RNA polymerase, and a small C-terminal domain that carries determinants for interaction with promoter DNA and with regulators. The two domains are connected by a very long, very flexible linker, and this linker allows the C-terminal domains, the regulatory input domains, to occupy different locations in space relative to the remainder of RNA polymerase and its context.
This 15 nanometer size just gave includes already the fully structure?
No. So in the structure that you see, you are seeing only the N-terminal domain of alpha 1 and only the N-terminal domain of alpha 2. The linker and C-terminal domain were not resolved in the crystallographic study, presumably precisely because of their structural mobility, meaning that in different molecules in the crystal lattice, the C-terminal domains occupy different locations relative to the remainder of the protein. Nevertheless, from the length of the linker, which is about 40 angstroms, or 0.4 nanometers, and from the, sorry, 4 nanometers, and from the points of attachment of the linkers onto the N-terminal domain, one can estimate the range of positions that the C-terminal domains could access, and that's the purpose of the dashed line.
So you commented that you said alpha 1 and alpha 2 have the same sequence.
In bacteria.
In bacteria, but different structural positions. Do you understand why they, you wouldn't have ended up drifting with two different...
In archaea and in eukaryotes, you have. So in archaea and eukaryotes, there are two distinct polypeptides, two paralogs, similar in sequence to each other, similar in sequence to the molecule in bacteria, but they are different.
It's a single copy, though.
That's right.
Okay,
so in bacteria, they've not separated. In archaea and in eukaryotes, two distinct paralogs. Okay, so this is the overall structure. One remaining subunit, small subunit omega, is also located distal to the active center cleft. This assembly has all the determinants required for catalysis. It has all the determinants required to initiate transcription, perform transcription, and terminate transcription in a sequence-independent fashion. No. So I've not mentioned sigma. I'm coming to that momentarily. These are the core subunits, beta prime, beta, alpha 1, alpha 2, and omega. This is the core assembly that has all the catalytic determinants, can carry out transcription, but has very limited to no sequence preferences in its initiation. It's not a member of this protein family. This protein family is the multi-subunit RNA polymerase family. That constitutes all the cellular RNA polymerases in all living organisms. However, there are also a group of polymerases, RNA polymerases, called single subunit RNA polymerases that are found in chloroplasts in eukaryotes, in mitochondria in eukaryotes, and in a number of viral encoded proteins, including T7 RNA polymerase. It is structurally unrelated. It's structurally much more related to the DNA polymerases. It is not part of this family. It's structurally and mechanistically distinct. These are the polymerases, however, that are responsible for the cellular RNA polymerase inside a bacterium or archaea, or in the nuclear transcription inside eukaryotes. Okay, so returning to this, again, this assembly can do non-specific transcription initiation, but can't initiate at specific sites. To initiate at specific sites, this core assembly must unite with an initiation factor termed sigma. Sigma is a sequence-specific DNA binding protein. When bound to RNA polymerase core enzyme, it acquires the ability to recognize specific DNA sequences called promoters. It conveys the enzyme to the promoters. It also helps orchestrate the events in initiation. The events in initiation are complex. The polymerase, in the form of holoenzyme containing both core and sigma, carries out a series of reactions. Thus, RNA polymerase holoenzyme R binds to its target on DNA, a promoter, P, initially to form an RNA polymerase promoter closed complex in which the DNA is double-stranded and largely undeformed. This is a reversible interaction. These components are in rapid exchange. RNA polymerase holoenzyme then melts about 14 nucleotides of DNA surrounding the transcription start site, rendering accessible the genetic information in the template strand of DNA, thereby yielding an RNA polymerase promoter open complex. The melted region, 14 nucleotides in length, is referred to as the transcription bubble. It's formed at this step, and it's maintained in all subsequent steps of transcription through to termination. It's propagated as the enzyme moves, moving with the enzyme within the bounds of the enzyme. Having formed the open complex, RNA polymerase holoenzyme is able to use the genetic information in the template strand of DNA together with nucleoside triphosphates, NTPs. This represents ATP, CTP, GTP, and UTP, ribonucleoside triphosphates. It's able to use the template information together with nucleoside triphosphates to begin synthesis of RNA as an RNA polymerase promoter initial transcribing complex. In principle, the enzyme can proceed directly to processive elongation, but in practice, more typically, it enters into multiple cycles, abortive cycles, of synthesis and release of short RNA products, products that are shorter than a critical threshold length of about 9 nucleotides. Typically, the enzyme will enter into tens, hundreds, or even thousands of abortive cycles of synthesis and release of short products. This abortive cycling phenomenon occurs because short RNA products are held in the enzyme active center only by base pairing of the RNA product to the DNA template strand. And short RNA-DNA hybrids are kinetically unstable. They're labile, and so the product RNA tends to dissociate from the active center as quickly as it can be synthesized. So in this stage, the enzyme literally enters into a race when it begins synthesis of an RNA chain, a race to extend it to the critical threshold length of 9 nucleotides or lose it. Usually it loses that race, it releases the product, it starts again and again until stochastically it succeeds in synthesizing a product of the critical threshold length.
So it does seem that the RNA polymerase stays transcribed and then leaves the RNA and comes back to.
So the active center of the enzyme moves forward, synthesizing the RNA product, The RNA product is released. The active sensor again starts, moves forward, releases RNA, returns, multiple cycles. In the literature, it's not established whether the enzyme as a whole is moving in this process. We, however, in collaboration with Shimon Weiss and his coworkers, formerly at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, now at UCLA, have performed single molecule experiments that show the entire enzyme, not just the active center, is making transient excursions forward when it releases an RNA, coming back, and doing this again and again and again until stochastically it succeeds in synthesizing a product of a critical length. The critical length is 9, and so these abortive products are 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9 nucleotides in length. When the enzyme reaches the critical threshold length, now the RNA is long enough so that it can be attached to the complex, not only by base pairing to the DNA template strand, but also it's long enough to poke into a tunnel that passes through the body of the enzyme, a literal enclosed tunnel. And now the RNA is tightly coupled to the complex, being bound not only by base pairing, but also threading into a tunnel in the enzyme. That tunnel, the entry of that tunnel, triggers breakage of interactions by RNA polymerase with the promoter DNA. So it irrevocably breaks its interactions with the promoter DNA. It also irrevocably weakens or optionally breaks its interactions with the initiation factor sigma, and now enters into productive elongation, during which process the enzyme translocates along the DNA up to tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of nucleotides long, retaining the RNA product, stably synthesizing RNA as it goes. Correct. 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 You'll hear a great deal more about that later.
The sequence of the initial transcription bubble.
Yes.
No,
not exceptionally. The what directs melting to that location is not the sequence of the bubble itself, but the binding site for the sigma factor, the initiation factor. It parks the holoenzyme in a specific location, and then the bubble forms next to and partly overlapping that location, irrespective of sequence. So there are sequence determinants for binding of the enzyme. They're not a distinct, separate set of sequence determinants for melting. All of these phenomena apply equally to bacteria, archaea, and eukaryotes.
And then say the T7?
Strikingly, despite the fact that T7 RNA polymerase is a single subunit RNA polymerase, and despite the fact that I told you there's no structural similarity whatsoever, there's no sequence similarity whatsoever, it shows many of the same basic properties of proceeding through a closed complex, an open complex, an initial transcribing complex with abortive synthesis, and a critical threshold length of 9. This may, in fact, reflect something about physical chemical properties of nucleic acids, optimal lengths of duplex and single-stranded regions, that two enzymes that arrived at such very different structural mechanistic solutions nevertheless go through very similar, analogous pathways. Not homologous, but analogous. Okay, so now we're in elongation. I keep hitting page up. So elongation is a discontinuous process. The enzyme proceeds in fits of productive elongation, followed by intervals of pausing and editing, followed by resumed productive elongation. Thus, after each phosphodiester bond is formed, after each nucleotide bond, after each nucleotide is added to the growing RNA chain in the bond form, so-called phosphodiester bond, the enzyme stochastically can branch out of the processive elongation mode into an alternative mode involving pausing, and further can branch into an alternative mode involving editing. And once in an alternative mode, such as pausing or editing, stochastically the enzyme can recover back to the processive elongation mode and resume transcription. These are stochastic processes. They can occur at any nucleotide, and different polymerase molecules do them at different times and spend different amounts of time in pausing and editing. Nevertheless, there are sequence determinants for these processes. Certain sequences have a higher degree of likelihood to pause than others, and that will be a focus of much of the rest of the talk. So you have a discontinuous process of bursts of rapid processive elongation, at which point the enzyme is adding about one nucleotide per 30 milliseconds on the average, followed by pauses, followed by rapid elongation, proceeding literally for thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands of nucleotides until a specific termination signal is obtained, at which point RNA polymerase releases the RNA, The bubble collapses, the transcription bubble collapses to yield double-stranded DNA, and polymerase falls off, and that event is called termination. Absolutely, I said there are sequence influence, there are sequence determinants. For any given sequence, experimentally, one can define a probability of pause, and for a pause molecule, a lifetime, average lifetime of the pause. But it's a stochastic process, and different molecules proceeding through either do it or don't. There are some other proteins to help at each step along this pathway. Again, most regulation of gene expression occurs at the level of the pathway I've just drawn. There are known regulators of each and every one of the steps shown here. Activators work by increasing any of the forward rate constants, or decreasing any of the reverse rate constants, or decreasing probability of entry into alternative modes or dwell times in alternative modes. And repressors have the opposite effect. And again, there are documented examples of activators and repressors at each step along the pathway. So regulation can happen. Okay, so this particular pathway, the best characterized factors that affect that in bacteria are called Gre factors. There are two paralogous proteins, Gre-A and Gre-B. These are factors that combine to RNA polymerase that is in one class of pause, which we'll learn more about, and can pop the enzyme, induce the enzyme to leave the pausing mode, enter an editing mode, and following the editing mode to resume productive elongation. So an example of a regulatory factor that works by promoting escape from one class of pause would be Gre-A or Gre-B, which do so by inducing cycling through editing back to productive elongation. Okay, so my focus in today's talk is going to be elongation. For those people who are familiar with my work, this may be a surprise because our laboratory's primary focus is initiation. The reason that I've chosen to speak on elongation, pausing, editing, and termination today is that I think that out of all the steps along the pathway, this is perhaps the step most amenable to a physical description. This is the step in which the tape of DNA with unidimensional sequence information is read out by a molecule moving along that tape. Therefore, this is the step that is most amenable, I believe, to a quantitative simulation and to an informatics approach in order to relate sequence to properties and in order to define likely pause sites, likely termination sites, likely points of regulation, as well as likely points for introduction of noise and stochasticity into gene expression. Another reason that I've chosen to focus on this section is that our work in this area is being performed in collaboration with someone who is known to some of you, namely Anirban Sengupta, who was formerly at Bell Labs and now is at Rutgers University in the Department of Physics. And a third reason is that our work in this area is at a very early stage, and this represents much of a conceptual outline of our approach rather than a description of completed experiments, and therefore I think is more suitable for an informal presentation of this type. In the rest of the seminar, I'll be gradually making a transition from PowerPoint to chalk talk as I move to description of a hypothesis, of the experiments we're using to carrying out to address that hypothesis, and of the quantitative simulation and informatics approaches we're using to try to provide a complete description of the process. Okay, first, what are the key issues for elongation? First and foremost is the mechanism of elongation. How is force generated? The enzyme moves. It is a molecular motor. It is one of the most powerful molecular motors known. This molecular motor generates 50 piconewtons of force in a forward direction. How is that force generated? In particular, how does one couple the chemical information in the nucleoside triphosphate to the mechanical energy that drives forward motion? Second question is, how is this process, which can occur in a processive fashion over hundreds of thousands of nucleotides, suddenly and with extremely high efficiency terminated at specific signals? How does pausing occur? How does editing occur? What influences or biases likely sites of editing? Very importantly, what are the sequence effects that determine sites of termination, pausing, and editing? Can one provide a quantitative simulation of these processes and the sequence effects? And can one adapt this for informatics analysis so that one could take genomic sequence and predict from sequence alone all likely points of regulation, all likely points of termination, pausing, and editing along the sequence? So I will briefly summarize what we know about elongation, and then we'll shift to a description of our hypothesis that attempts to rationalize all of these points. First, with respect to the reaction, the single nucleotide addition reaction is summarized here. One has an RNA of length N, a nucleoside triphosphate, which can be any one of the four ribonucleoside triphosphates, the identity of which is determined by the template. This then yields an RNA which has increased in length by one, and the byproduct of pyrophosphate being released. The reaction can proceed in a forward direction or with lower efficiency in a reverse direction. The reverse reaction, called pyrophosphorylation, provides one of the two editing mechanisms for removal of incorrectly incorporated nucleotides. It is the less important of the two editing mechanisms, and I'll say nothing more about it unless asked. Now, from mechanism to structure. The following is known information based on extensive studies involving crystallography, spectroscopy, biochemistry, and genetics in many laboratories. This is a schematic picture based on much experimental work of the structural organization of the transcription elongation complex. In bold black, you have two strands of DNA. The top strand is the non-template strand. The bottom strand is the template strand, the one that contains the genetic information that's being transcribed into RNA. There is a 14 nucleotide melted region. This is the transcription bubble, which I told you was formed in the open complex and is propagated throughout the process of elongation. 14 nucleotides melted. There's an RNA product shown here in red. 9 nucleotides of the RNA product, representing the 9 most recently added, the 9 that are closest to the growing end, or 3 prime end of the RNA, are present as a hybrid between RNA and DNA within the active center of the enzyme. All the remainder of nucleotides of RNA, although synthesized earlier, are in single-stranded form. This nucleic acid scaffold, or nucleic acid lattice, is embedded with an RNA polymerase, shown schematically in shading. RNA polymerase tightly surrounds all of the nucleic acid determinants so tightly that there is no access by other molecules to the active center except through the paths that I'll mention. No access to molecules even the size of a water molecule. So this is a tightly enclosed, completely sealed compartment. And we have to imagine that this gray would surround it across the entire surface in 3 dimensions. The enzyme has a channel through which the DNA passes. It has a large channel that accommodates the template strand and hybrid of RNA. It has a channel that accommodates the non-template strand of DNA. It has a literal tunnel that serves as the RNA exit channel. This is a tunnel 50 angstroms long and 20 angstroms wide that can accommodate single-stranded DNA, a single-stranded RNA, and accommodates exactly 5 nucleotides of RNA as shown. It contains a second tunnel, which again drills literally through the surface of the enzyme like a tunnel, about 50 angstroms long, 20 angstroms wide, and that leads to the active center, shown here in blue. This is the tunnel through which the nucleoside triphosphate substrates enter to get to the active center, and this is the tunnel by which the byproduct, pyrophosphate, leaves. This also serves as a tunnel for release of edited RNA products by both modes of editing. They fall out through this tunnel. More on that later. So, yes?
So you said that the whole thing was so tight with water, but obviously through this channel, lots of other dyes that we don't want.
That's right. So the only means of access in the material elongation complex is this tunnel. This tunnel is sufficiently broad that it can accommodate a broad range of molecules, many, many small molecules.
So there are many at the same time there, so the right one can bind.
That's correct. But this is you have to think this is like the Holland Tunnel. There's tremendous two-way traffic going on here. And not only traffic of nucleotides and pyrophosphate, but all small molecules in the cell, because there's no obvious sieving mechanism that can keep unwanted molecules out here. So many small molecules enter here and retreat. All of this is occurring on a time scale of 30 milliseconds per nucleotide addition on the average during elongation. So that is the structure of the elongation complex. That is well established and not open to serious doubt. It is also well established and not open to serious doubt that the protein, namely the shaded material, can translocate bidirectionally on this nucleic acid scaffold. Thus, it is known. Oh, before going to that, let me just say that I will refer to this as state zero. This represents the state immediately after formation of a phosphodiester bond, in addition to the last nucleotide to the growing RNA chain. Also refer to this as untranslocated. This is the enzyme at the instant of nucleotide addition. It is established that the enzyme is able to undergo reverse translocation, sliding back or backtracking on the nucleic acid lattice by one nucleotide. When this happens, the enzyme must break a DNA base pair at the upstream end of the bubble, reform a DNA-DNA base pair at the downstream end of the bubble in order to maintain a constant bubble of 14 nucleotides. It breaks an RNA-DNA base pair near the active center, threading the 3' end of the RNA into this tunnel, and it forms a new RNA-DNA base pair at the upstream end of the hybrid to maintain a constant hybrid length of 9 nucleotides. This is a known reaction. The enzyme can move back one nucleotide. It can also move back 2, 3, or n nucleotides, literally up to tens or hundreds of nucleotides sliding backwards along its template. Returning to the untranslocated state, it is also clear that the enzyme can undergo forward translocation. Thus, it can translocate forward by one step, which requires breaking a DNA base pair at this end of the bubble, reforming a DNA-DNA base pair at this end of the bubble, breaking an RNA-DNA base pair at this end of the hybrid, and leaving a vacant spot for an incoming nucleotide. This represents the state prepared or poised to receive the next nucleotide for addition onto the growing RNA chain. It has also been proposed, although not observed, that the enzyme can undergo further forward translocation without synthesis by 2, 3, 4, or more nucleotides. And such further forward translocation would be referred to as hypertranslocation, translocation beyond the normal N plus 1 step. Okay, again, these represent established properties of the enzyme. One further established point is that one and only one of those translocational states can accept an incoming nucleotide. That is the state in which the enzyme has translocated in a forward direction by exactly one position. When that occurs, the incoming leukocyte triphosphate, shown here in magenta and green, can access through the nucleotide uptake channel, form a base pair with the template strand, and load in position to form the next bond. A nucleoside triphosphate has a structure as shown here schematically. It has the portion that will be incorporated into the growing RNA chain, boxed here in magenta, and that's shown in magenta on the screen. And it has the portion that will be released as pyrophosphate as the byproduct, boxed in green, and that's shown in green here. The NTP, when it binds into the forward translocated state of the elongation complex, binds by base pairing with the template strand, stacking on the 3' base of the RNA, and making extensive interactions with the triphosphate and the active center of the enzyme. So a three-way interaction between the DNA template strand, the RNA 3' end, and the enzyme active center. Again, this represents the baseline information of what is known from extensive studies representing structural, biophysical, biochemical, and genetic studies of the elongation complex. At this point, I would like to turn to our hypothesis that attempts to rationalize this information and provide a structural mechanism for elongation, termination, pausing, editing, sequence effects. Well, so the hypothesis that I'm going to underline is that they are Brownian motions. You're going to hear much about this. You're already about 15 minutes or 30 minutes ahead of the point where I am in the talk. But this, you've already thought through many of the issues, including the fact that the reverse translocation is essentially a flat energy landscape. Well, you'll hear much more on that momentarily. So the key assumptions of this model, which we refer to as a Brownian ratchet model, are that the transcription elongation complex, TEC, alternates between two states. State 1, which has an unfixed translocational register of the protein relative to the nucleic acid lattice, in which the protein is able to undergo bidirectional sampling of different translocational microstates. And state 2, which is a fixed translocational register, where the enzyme is locked in a single translocational microstate. This state 2, furthermore, is proposed to occur only when the incoming nucleoside triphosphate, the incoming NTP, is bound to the complex. The second assumption is that partitioning among the translocational microstates, when in state 1, is rapid relative to NTP binding. That is to say that the moment a phosphodiester bond is formed, the enzyme rapidly can sample a range of, and possibly all, translocational microstates and reach either a full equilibrium among translocational microstates or at least approximate an equilibrium, all in the time scale that's less than the time scale for NTP to find its way through that tunnel and bind into the active center. And the third assumption is that partitioning among the translocational microstates in this state 1 is governed by nucleic acid duplex thermodynamics. That is to say that the energies of each of the translocational microstates are dominated by and possibly completely determined by the thermodynamics of nucleic acid duplex formation, which is calculable and predictable. And as a result, if the energies are predictable, the occupancies of those microstates will be predictable, and the functional properties of the complex would be predictable. So let's discuss how this model works. Again, we return to a view of the untranslocated state. According to this model, the untranslocated translocational state, 0, this model suggests that that state 1, with an enzyme that is able to undergo translocational equilibration, the model proposes that the enzyme is able, in this state, to sample the untranslocated microstate 0, as well as all reverse translocated microstates, as well as all forward translocated microstates. For the sake of simplicity, I'll just show one other, which is the forward translocated state translocated by 1. And according to this model, basically the enzyme is sampling these states on a rapid time scale, and also is sampling for the reverse translocated and for the forward translocated states. I'll be coming to that momentarily, most certainly not. And so I'll be discussing at length the energy landscape. But first, the properties. So it's a translocational equilibration process driven by thermal energy. So this represents a one-dimensional bidirectional Brownian walk of the protein on the nucleic acid lattice in this state. There's no net directionality, backwards and forwards, and as you'll see momentarily, it actually is energetically preferable to remain stationary or move backwards. It is energetically disfavored to move forward. So you have a translocational Brownian walk, bidirectional. Only in this state is there a site available for the incoming NTP. The proposal is that when the incoming NTP binds, it does two things. It stabilizes this forward translocated state, forward translocated by 1 unit, and it locks the system, locks the transcription elongation complex into the state 2, the fixed state that no longer is amenable to translocational equilibration. So that's a simple model. In the absence of nucleotide, there's a translocational equilibration among multiple states. In the presence of nucleotide, this state is stabilized, therefore pulling the equilibrium to this state and locked in place. You thus have a Brownian ratchet, thermal energy providing the motive force, binding of the NTP serving as the pull of the ratchet. That's a macroscopic description of the model. For a microscopic description of the model, we would ask, why should this state be translocationally unfixed? And why should the state with NTP be translocationally fixed? You'll note that in this state, there are no interactions between the protein and the nucleic acid lattice that can identify the location within the nucleic acid lattice. Thus, in this state, whether one was in position 0, position plus 1, or reverse translocated position, the enzyme is not making a specific interaction with the nucleic acid template that can identify the translocational register. Thus, in this state, all possible translocational registers can be sampled. In contrast, when the NTP is bound, there now is an interaction, a cross-bridge interaction, between the nucleic acid lattice and the protein. That cross-bridge interaction involves base pairing of the NTP with the DNA template strand, stacking of the base of the NTP on the RNA 3' end, and bonding of the triphosphate moiety of the NTP to the active center of the enzyme. Thus, the moment the NTP binds, there's stabilizing binding energy coming from three sources, and there's a cross-bridge between the nucleic acid lattice and the protein that locks the elongation complex in this state. If you look again at the structure of an NTP, this part of the NTP would be engaged in Watson-Crick base pairing with the template strand of DNA. This portion would be involved in base stacking with the RNA 3' end. And this portion would be involved in interactions with the active center. This is a chemically functionally rich group area. This has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 hydrogen bond accepting atoms, and has a net negative charge of -3. From structural studies that are done of polymerase nucleotide complexes, it is apparent that each and every one of these hydrogen bonding atoms has its hydrogen bonding character satisfied, and the electrostatic balance is maintained. So there are extensive interactions between the protein and this group that serve to provide a cross bridge. Strikingly, the moment the phosphodiester bond is formed, this cross bridge is broken. Thus, when the phosphodiester bond is formed between the incoming nucleotide and the 3' end, this entire linkage between the unit in green and the unit in purple is irrevocably broken. And therefore, the cross bridge between the nucleic acid lattice on this side and the protein active center is irrevocably broken. So the moment that bond is formed, the pyrophosphate is released, and you transition back to state one, the unfixed state. So, I'll get to that momentarily and explain the consequences.
Can you just remind me what the binding energy or the
I can give you estimates for each of these interactions. So the Watson-Crick base pairs have been extensively studied, and in water these are contributing on the order of 1 kcal per mole. So they're about 2 kcals per mole that are due to hydrogen bond formation. There's an additional about 2 kcals per mole that's dependent on base stacking. The exact values of these interactions will depend on the nucleotide and on the base on which it's stacking, but on the order of 2 to 5 kcals per mole for overall interactions on this side. The interactions on this side will be very significantly more energetically stabilizing. Again, in this case, one is anticipating that each of these atoms will participate in at least one and up to three hydrogen bonds, each generating about 1 kcal per mole, and with electrostatic stabilization of 3 negative charges balanced by 3 positive charges for a further 3 kcals per mole. So the energy of binding is dominated by these interactions. These interactions also play a role. Now, so I'm defining this. This I defined before you arrived. I said that this represents the active center, the collection of magnesium ions at the active center together with side chains of the protein at the active center.
So the hydrogen
So you have information from the KM of nucleotides, and there's an enormous variation in KM of nucleotides with sequence, and we can get to that later as well. But from the average KM and from binding studies giving KD, one is able to relate these estimates to actual amount, and it works out well to imagine that there's a significant contribution of energy on this side connected to the nucleic acid lattice, but a dominant contribution on this side connected to the active center, the magnesium ions of the active center and associated side chains. And the beauty of this system, the beauty of this design of this Brownian ratchet, is that it's able to use thermal energy to drive motion. It's able to use binding energy to rectify the two-dimensional Brownian walk. You have a two-dimensional Brownian walk that is rectified by binding energy of the binding of the NTP, and you have a cleavage event that resets the mechanism, pulls out the ratchet. And it's not a cleavage mechanism that had to be built in as an extra regulatory step. It's the cleavage mechanism that is part of the intrinsic catalytic step of introducing the nucleotide on. So the simplest of all possible designs, the least efficient of all possible, most efficient of all possible designs.
So
I still can't hear you.
What is KT in calories per mole?
Ah, what is KT in kcals per mole? Someone has to help me. So I think it's on the order of 0.5. Okay, so on the order of 0.5, so 0.6. Okay. Now, let's see what comes next. So I've talked about the macroscopic force generation, namely its Brownian motion, rectified by binding, reset by cleavage. Now an issue of the force land, of the energy landscape for the motion. And several people have asked questions about that. He asked a question about that some half an hour ago, perhaps. So the energy landscape for the motion. If we consider state zero, the untranslocated microstate, and now the microstate in which reverse translocation by one step has occurred. To do this, you broke one DNA base pair here. You reformed a DNA base pair there. So in terms of DNA base pairing, it's isoenergetic. You've broken an RNA DNA base pair here, but you've reformed an RNA DNA base pair here. So in terms of RNA DNA base pairing, it's isoenergetic. So if we make an inventory of the base pairs, two are broken, two are formed, there's no net change in base pairing. If we then consider state zero and set that as the zero point in terms of number of base pairs, the reverse translocated state, reverse translocated by one position, has no net change in base pairs. And so it's a flat energy landscape to reverse translocate by one step, neglecting sequence effects. We actually know we know from experimental measurements performed in our laboratory, we know the energetic contribution of occupancy of each nucleotide into this channel, as well as the energetic contribution of each nucleotide into this channel. And for the sake of this argument, we should neglect those. They're very small. This has the binding of the first nucleotide into this channel is unfavorable by about 1 kcal per mole. Subsequent binding events in here have essentially no effect. In this channel, each additional nucleotide contributes about 1 kcal per mole in incremental binding for energy. But these contributions are very small relative to the base pair contribution that we've been talking about.
If I had a long enough hairpin, sort of halfway out at this point, it seems like you could imagine a situation where energetically it would want to suck itself out instead of...
Well, so you're another person who's a half hour further ahead in the talk. I mean, once you see this, it's obvious how it all works. And the remarkable thing is the molecular biologists and biochemists studying this for decades just don't see this.
So what if you break a GC base pair and form an AT base pair? Then there
isn't. Absolutely. So for the moment, at this point in the talk, I'm talking neglecting base sequence effects, and I'll move to those at the next level. But so this is reverse translocated by one step. To reverse translocate by two steps, it's also isogenic in terms of base pairing. You've broken four, you've formed four. So going back two steps, still a flat energy landscape. The same thing is true if you go back three steps or n steps. So reverse translocation, neglecting sequence effects, is a flat energy landscape.
I mean, anytime you're going to move from two phases, it shouldn't be really draw a point there between those two phases.
I'm drawing a gap. Okay, so these lines are reflecting the energies of the microstates, not the transition. So in all accuracy, these should be interrupted lines.
So, I mean, still you have to have some thermal energy to get over.
It's thermal energy that drives the equilibration between the states. So the transitions between the microstates are driven by thermal energy. But right now I'm talking about the equilibrium occupant, the thermodynamic energies of the individual states. That's the second element of the hypothesis, is the assumption that you can reach a true equilibrium or approach a true equilibrium on a time scale that's short relative to the time scale of NTP binding. That's correct. That's correct. These cannot be enormous bumps, or if they are enormous bumps, those will be microstates that aren't sampled in the appropriate time scale.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's correct.
So you can't possibly leave with that fast.
Potentially. And so when we talk about quantitative simulation, we'll talk about what kinds of limits you have to place on that and why there are limits on that that come from the nature of the transcription process. Okay, so reverse translocation in the absence of sequence effect is a flat energy landscape. What about forward translocation? In forward translocation, had to break a base pair here, reform a base pair there. So in terms of DNA base pairing, it's isoenergetic. But it's not isoenergetic in terms of RNA base pairing, in that an RNA-DNA base pair is broken here, but none is reformed. So to go forward, there's a net loss of one base pair. And so to go forward to position plus one, there's a step upward. There's been a loss of one base pair. The energy landscape has now involved an uphill transition. The enzyme does not like to sample the forward position. The same is true for each subsequent forward translocation. Each subsequent forward translocation comes at the loss of one base pair. Thus, as one moves forward, you're climbing up a hill, again neglecting sequence effects. So you have an energy landscape that from microstate zero and negative microstates is flat, neglecting sequence effects. Forward translocated and hypertranslocated microstates are up a hill. Therefore, according to this notion that you either reach or approach an equilibrium among translocational microstates, means that there will be significant occupancy of zero and negative numbers, much lower occupancies of positive numbers with decreasing, progressively decreasing occupancies as positive numbers increase.
So I agree with him. If you make the state space go arbitrarily far back, then the amount of occupation of that
maybe I should answer this now so that this is not a nagging point. In the quantitative simulation that if we get to them I will talk about, we put that a constraint of 50 nucleotides. We consider only 50 nucleotides behind the enzyme. And the basis for putting a constraint there, two of the physiological bases are that in vivo, one, there will be second molecules of RNA polymerase on the template that provide a backstop to reverse translocation. And two, for a protein encoding gene, there will be ribosomes on the RNA translating that provide a backstop to reverse translocation. From considerations of average translation time compared to average transcription time, the expectation is that the average space that's available behind an enzyme will be on the order of 50 base pairs. And so that state space, we would probably say, is about 50 base pairs.
That critically determines the rate at which it's going to go forward, right? If you had said 25,
That's correct. And there is a paper which is under review for publication right now that is directly showing that in vitro, if there is a second enzyme behind a first enzyme, providing a backstop, that this erases almost all pausing behavior observed and dramatically increases the overall elongation rate, precisely consistent with that notion. So in our idea, we'd like to consider if our state space has 50 nucleotides behind the enzyme. That's somewhat arbitrary, but it's a best guess based on the relative times of transcription and translation. It's also, for a quantitative simulation, absolutely essential to put some limit on there, because otherwise the RNA length becomes too large to model the RNA structure, RNA secondary structure, behind the enzyme. Oh, that also that helps limit the available space. As RNA folds up behind the enzyme, it provides a backstop to reverse translocation. Same thing. Okay, so that's our energy landscape. One exception, when the nucleotide's present, this state, the state translated by one, now is, in terms of base pairing, isoenergetic because you've made an additional base pair, but because you also have the interactions with the triphosphate that I mentioned, this becomes more favorable. So in the absence of nucleotide, you have a flat profile behind, a steeply sloped profile ahead. In the presence of nucleotide, this particular state is, neglecting sequence effects, made the most favorable state. Okay, now sequence effects. All of this is just treating base pairs as base pairs, but not all base pairs are created equal. So GC base pairs and CG base pairs, and this includes both DNA-DNA and RNA-DNA base pairs, have three hydrogen bonds between the two bases and are highly stable. AT base pairs and AT base pairs and TA base pairs, where these are both DNA, and TA base pairs, where this is DNA and this is RNA, have two hydrogen bonds and have good stacking. They're less stable than these, but significantly stable. A base pair that has DNA A and RNA U has two bonds between the bases, but has very poor stacking of the U on the base adjacent to us, and therefore is the weakest. So GC base pairs and CG base pairs, irrespective of whether they're DNA or RNA or mixed, are strong. These three classes of base pairs are intermediate, and this base pair is extremely weak. These differences in base pair stabilities obviously impact the relative energies of the microstates if one's considering actual sequence rather than arbitrary sequence. Thus, if one is forming a GC base pair and breaking an AT base pair, the consequences are very different than if one were doing the reverse. Thus, these energy landscapes for an actual template sequence would be modified upward or downward based on the duplex stabilities, the thermodynamics of DNA-DNA, DNA-RNA, and RNA-RNA duplex formation. Thus, one can imagine, and one can easily show, sequences where some of the reverse translocated positions would be predicted to be much more stable even than the forward translocated position with nucleotide bound. Such sequences are sequences that one would anticipate to be very likely to have polymerase spend a significant amount of its time, or a significant fraction of the population of RNA polymerase, in an inappropriate microstate rather than a functional microstate. Also, one can find positions where the height of this functional microstate can be either anomalously high or anomalously low. And this accounts, we would suggest, for the very large difference in Km for substrate as a function of sequence. Those sites where this energy is predicted to be very, very favorable are sites where you would expect a low Km. That means very high binding of nucleotide. Sites where this is unfavorable are sites where you would expect high Km, because binding energy, a larger fraction of binding energy, has to be used to drive the equilibrium to this unfavorable state.
So I think you'll want to answer that. So you could engineer for some of these sequences to show this very dramatically.
Absolutely. Yes. So you can engineer them, or you can identify them in natural sequence. Or even in the simplest case, you can take the existing literature, which is large, of sequences that are known to be sites for very long-term pausing, including even irreversible pausing termed arrest, or sites that are sites for termination, and then you can explain them, ask whether it's possible to explain them in these terms, and you can explain these in these terms. You can also identify them in advance in these terms. Okay, what comes next? Oh, yes. Okay, so that's the basic elongation mechanism according to the model. The idea that it's a Brownian walk, bidirectional, rectified by binding of the incoming nucleotide, its binding energy being used to drive the equilibrium of microstates to one particular one, its binding energy also being used to lock the transition, the translocational register at that point until bond formation occurs. Yes? Yes.
What you're going to do is that you're going to tilt your...
Absolutely. 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 So
what they expect in that case is that the velocity should depend very sensitively on the force. But the experiment has shown that the velocity does not depend on the force.
Well, so there are three groups that have published this work, the Bloch group, the Bustamante group, and the Wine group. There are three sets of results which are incompatible both in the basic results and in the interpretation. And so it's at this point premature to interpret that. The interpretation that is most consistent with this view is the interpretation of the results and interpretation from Michelle Wang's lab. Her results and her interpretation are completely consistent with this view.
But the velocity that they report, Michelle Wang, also they report the velocity of translocation does not depend on the force that you are putting on the
So part of the issue also has to come with what...
But if the force is pulling, then you're more you go backwards, more energy you gain, and therefore you would expect
So the question is, if you apply a force that assists forward translocation, an assisting force, or you apply a force that opposes forward translocation, an opposing force, does that in fact tilt this curve? And with what step size of translocation at the rate limiting step do you obtain for the analysis? And what all of the groups find is that the average velocity is unchanged, although Michelle Wang's group, differently from, say, Steve Block's group, sees important effects on pausing, consistent with a pattern reverse translocation. The key thing is on average velocity. And so the question is, does the assisting force or opposing force, does that act at the rate limiting step for this process? So what, according to this mechanism, is the rate limiting step? So according to the hypothesis that I've just laid out, you have an equilibration. That equilibration process affects the free energy of this state, both in its unoccupied and NTP occupied state.
If the concentration in the one state, concentration free state, is tilted, then the whole Boltzmann distribution, because if the argument is that the Boltzmann distribution would be tilted towards the minus n bar. So the probability of falling into the plus one state once the NTP binds
if in fact that is the limiting step. So there are variations on this. This is something that if anyone can help me out here, I would very much appreciate help on this. If anyone has any insights on how this might be able to impact on this, there are various variations on this. One variation is to suggest that at many positions in the template, at the average position in the template, this equilibration rarely proceeds beyond state 0 and state 1, like in the cases where I was alternating between state 0 and state 1, and that reverse translocation is perhaps due to an activation energy barrier rarely sampled. So in that case, these are possible translocational microstates that would not be sampled at average positions and only at certain special positions, the kinds of pause positions where there are, in fact, observed effects of assisting and opposing forces. So one possibility is to say that there is not, in fact, an equilibration among all these states at each position, but only a small equilibration among state 0 and state plus 1 at most positions, and only certain sequences permitting the reverse translocation. Another way of addressing this is to say that the transition between these states, what determines the ability to enter into these states, is not a translocation event that determines the ability to enter into these states, that the limiting factor for entry into these states is not a translocation and therefore not susceptible to an assisting or opposing force. So for example, if we say that at most positions, this is all that one has to choose among, if one says that the activation energy barrier for sampling any of these at most positions is low, then the choice between these two is going to be a translocation of just one base pair, or just 3.5 angstroms, and that becomes consistent with Block, Bustamante, or Michelle Wang's data. So one way of resolving this is to say at many sites you don't sample any of these. But it's clearly the case that you must be able to sample these at some sites. It also is the case that if you leave nucleotides out, that you most certainly sample all of these, in that case where there's sufficient time for equilibration to occur. Does that provide an explanation? Does anyone else have suggestions?
I mean, this is probably stupid, but does one know for a fact that it's the whole DNA, RNA complex that translates with respect to the polymerase?
No, no. So it's the scaffold of nucleic acids of DNA plus RNA moves as a unit relative to the polymerase. That's definite. So the experiments are done at forces that are believed to be below the forces that are required to give the transition to stretched DNA. So the answer is presumably no.
now if one moves forward, you need to uncoil the double stranded. If it already stretched out, then you can move forward.
Does the issue of directionality matter, which is to say that this is RNA polymerase is not, as a physicist might model it, is not a dimensionless point with nucleic acids passing through it. So it cannot be modeled as a point with nucleic acids passing through it and an assisting or opposing force. In point of fact, the path of the nucleic acids through the enzyme is complex. There's a wrapping of nucleic acid through the enzyme. It could be reasonably well described as a Z shape. In this case, if you apply an assisting or an opposing force, but the actual translocation, the limiting, rate limiting translocation is occurring orthogonally to those forces, does it constitute an assisting or opposing force? Does anyone have, would it? Right.
And the point
is in this graph on the left side. Okay, so in the experiments, typically they're working with a polymerase that's anchored on a surface. And then they're pulling either on this end of the DNA or on this end of the DNA. But importantly, the DNA is not passing through the enzyme in a straight line, as shown in this schematic picture, but is instead passing through the enzyme in a complex path. And so if they're pulling in a direction that is not that is not parallel to the direction of translocation, does that constitute an assisting force, or does it not?
The question is whether protocols work against or not against. If during transcription, the length of the DNA decreases, that work is performed against the force. If during transcription, the length of the DNA increases, then work.
So you'd say that the details of path are not relevant.
Yeah, it's just a question whether. The details of what exactly energetics is
should not be relevant.
But it's rather the question whether it is helping transcription or hindering transcription.
But again, it depends. Again, you will only see on the parameter you mentioned, which is the least specific parameter, the average rate, that will only impact on the limiting step, the microscopic limiting step in the reaction, not the overall work, not net work, but the microscopic limiting step. And if the microscopic limiting step involves a translocation that is orthogonal to the applied force, is the applied force an assisting force or is it irrelevant? Is that a possible objection to the force experiments or is that not? I don't know. So Constantine, you were saying something just before, Constantine? Right.
With the nucleus, so you essentially have the same pattern going on, and when you show one experiment, you clearly show that the bottom is open. So you definitely do apply force on that thing. It's not a question about any kind of strain.
Right, but I don't think that's a comparable experiment at all. In that case, definitely the force is applied in a relevant direction, in that the nucleosome, by pulling on either end, is going to unravel the gyre. So that one I don't think is comparable to asking in a catalytic reaction, is the limiting step occurring along the pathway? That is something which, as he said, you're just looking at network. Anyone? So in answering that certainly is an issue. And the only thing I can answer is I can suggest that possibly, first and foremost, there are three sets of results. And one of the results actually says there is no pausing behavior that can be explained in terms of reverse translocation. That is incompatible with a wealth of biochemical experiment that unequivocally establishes reverse translocation is occurring. Those results, I think, those are Steve Block's, need to be discarded out of hand, both the results and the interpretation. The Bustamante and Michelle Wong results, they are consistent with reverse translocation, and in Michelle Wong's case is interpreted as such as reverse translocation. But they do see the absence of an effect of applied and assisting forces on overall average overall average elongation rate. And so then the question is that because they're measuring a force that is not in the direction or opposed to the direction of the microscopic limiting step? Or, and this would be my less preferred solution, does that mean that we have to invoke some type of activation energy barrier at most positions that means that we're really only dealing with a translocational equilibration between two states in most circumstances, and only at certain special sequences does one need to consider things outside that boundary. I don't know which one of these is appropriate or whether neither of those is appropriate. And if anyone has any suggestions, I would appreciate that. Okay. Well, that one's precisely analogous to the nuclear zone case, which Constantine said, if you have a rope around a pulley. And in that case, it's simply looking at net work. But if the limiting, in the case of measuring the average velocity of an enzymatic reaction, the only way there will be an effect is if the force occurs at the microscopic limiting step of the reaction. And if the microscopic step occurs in a direction orthogonal to the force, I don't know. I don't have a sense of whether that would or would not be relevant.
I think there's a problem with that argument, because if you change the rate at which you go into the state plus one,
mm-hmm.
right, so you just change the equilibrium,
mm-hmm.
if the rate limiting step has that frequency in it, because it has one part, so you have to wait for the right base to come in, but you also have to be in the right state.
Right.
Right. So anything that's going to decrease or increase the amount of time you spend in that state is going to affect the average rate which you elongate.
Right.
Now, I agree that if this thing goes through this polymerase in some weird way, then it's unclear what precisely is going to happen if you pull on one end of the DNA, right? So, but it may have a lot to do with the specifics of what happens to the DNA inside there. Like you were saying, maybe it will make it easier for the thing to go forward, maybe less easy to like the melting and the forming of the base of the DNA may now be skewed one way or the other.
So that was back to the idea that there's a compensating effect on DNA structure. So if I'm going to stipulate that the velocity, the effects of opposing and assisting forces in experiments of that nature on average velocity is inconsistent with a pattern of overall translocation, equilibration among all these states, unless one states that there is an issue about the directionality of the force relative to the direction of the microscopic limiting step. At this point, I'll stipulate that there's a discrepancy there, and I will reject the force measurements. and so something's got to go, and that's clearly the one.
So,
mm-hmm.
So what matters is how long it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Okay, so that comes back to the suggestion he made. And so I will stipulate that the only way you can fit this with this is to say if there is an error in the measurements, an error in the interpretation of the measurements, or the translocational equilibration at most positions is limited to two. But I prefer to reject that last assumption. And so I will plow on. Okay. So this was in terms of elongation. Now, part of the reason I consider this probably the most striking aspect of this model is that not only does it provide a mechanism for elongation, barring the force measurements on velocity, it also provides a rationalization of all information regarding termination, pausing, and editing. So let's consider termination first. In terms of this model, termination has a simple explanation, and that single simple explanation rationalizes all known examples of termination. According to this model, termination occurs when the enzyme samples a highly forward translocated state, a state where the enzyme has translocated by, for example, 9 steps forward. If the enzyme translocates 9 steps forward without synthesizing, it will completely run off the RNA. So with each step of forward translocation, the RNA hybrid is decreased by 1 nucleotide. If the enzyme were to translocate 9 steps forward without synthesis, the RNA-DNA hybrid would be removed completely. RNA would now exist only in the exit tunnel and outside the enzyme. And so the enzyme would run off of the RNA component of the nucleic acid scaffold. So are
right in front of the family center as and position that crossing after shortly in front of the point of termination, what would you see?
Well, so I know what the result of that is. And so you obviously don't know the most recent result with that. And so the result with that is completely consistent with that, and at the phage meeting was used by Jeff's group to make the case that forward translocation is the basis of termination. So the result of that from about 6 months ago is, or from about 10 months ago, is not the result of that as from the last 6 months. That, in fact, is completely consistent with this.
What are the results?
Okay, well, see, he's actually... Okay. Yeah, well, I'll get to that when I get to results that support this view rather than here, because you first have to say what the model is before talking about testing. But so the idea is that translocation comes about by hypertranslocation. According to this model, the enzyme rarely samples states that are highly forward translocated, because each further forward step is a step up the energy landscape. And so on the translocational equilibration, the population of a state in which the enzyme has moved 9 steps forward is essentially nil. As a result, the enzyme rarely will spontaneously translocate.
Can you apply your model also to the abortive cycle?
Absolutely.
Because then what you are predicting is that the probability of having a 9-1 is some Boltzmann factor.
Absolutely. So it's the same process that's occurring in abortive cycling as in the subsequent one. So abortive cycling is reverse translocation with a short RNA.
Since you have the data, does the data fit that?
Yes, it does. And if you had, you can just see this. If your RNA were only 3 nucleotides long and you reverse translocated by 3 steps, which is a flat energy landscape, you've lost the RNA. Okay, but so let's continue with termination. So termination, according to this model, represents hypertranslocation. 9 steps of hypertranslocation will give an enzyme that is no longer containing RNA within its active center. There is no more RNA-DNA hybrid. At that point, there is nothing to keep the 2 strands of the transcription bubble from collapsing, yielding double-stranded DNA. And it is known that when the enzyme is bound to double-stranded DNA, it is an unstable, reversible interaction where the enzyme can fall off. So the proposal is that termination will occur under any circumstances where the enzyme can be pushed forward by 5 to 9 steps, some number of steps approaching 9. How, in principle, could one push the enzyme forward? In principle, there are 4 ways that you could do this. You could imagine a factor that binds to DNA behind the enzyme using an energy source, such as ATP hydrolysis, translocates unidirectionally and snowplows the enzyme forward, pushing the enzyme up this uphill energy landscape. In fact, such a factor is known. It was identified within the last year, somewhere. Oh, I'm going the wrong direction, no wonder. Verse translocation. Yes, it was identified within the last year by Jeff Roberts and his coworkers. The factor is called MFD. It is an ATP hydrolase and DNA translocase, binds to DNA. It can be established directly to push the enzyme forward, and it will push the enzyme into a termination mode. A second way that you could have termination in this model would be to have a factor that binds on the RNA, uses an energy source such as ATP hydrolysis to translocate unidirectionally, and snowplows the enzyme forward. Such a factor has been known for decades. It is the protein Rho, which is an RNA binding protein, an ATP hydrolase, and RNA translocase. It has not been directly shown to push the enzyme forward, but it is known to induce termination. A third way would be to have a nucleic acid, for example, a DNA molecule that is complementary across its length to the segment of RNA spanning the segment in the exit channel and beyond. Such a nucleic acid, an antisense oligonucleotide, would be able to base pair with the segment of RNA outside the exit channel and would have the ability to base pair with the segment inside the channel if and only if the complex is sampling forward translocated states. For each step of forward translocation, one additional base pair between the antisense oligo and the RNA could be formed, driving the enzyme forward. It has been shown by Jeff Roberts and his coworkers about 5 years ago that an antisense oligonucleotide of this nature, in fact, does drive the enzyme forward, and that it induces termination. And it induces termination with the expected spatial relationship between the segment that has to be complementary and the 3' end of the RNA. So it causes termination at the expected position for a forward translocation model. And one would predict, in addition to the antisense oligo, one final mode of termination, and that would be a sequence within the RNA itself. A sequence within the RNA itself that was a sequence here in the RNA outside of the enzyme that was complementary to a sequence within the exit channel of the enzyme, and thus which would have the ability to form base pairs to that segment if and only if that segment were available outside the enzyme. Just as the antisense oligo would be able to work if, as the enzyme moves forward, this segment is revealed, a hairpin sequence would be able to work if, as the enzyme moves forward, this segment is revealed. So basically, if you had MFD pushing behind, Rho pushing here, or an antisense oligo pushing here, two burning ATP, one forming base pairs, they will push the enzyme up this energy landscape so it can drop off the cliff and terminate. Or, if you have a sequence, an appropriate sequence in the RNA, it will be able to, by itself, base pair and transform this energy landscape so that this energy landscape is not an uphill energy landscape with a loss of a base pair per step, but is a flat energy landscape because a new base pair is being formed, an RNA-RNA base pair, with each step. Now, this, in fact, is the mode of termination that is used most frequently in bacterial cells. This is called a factor-independent terminator. It is found ubiquitously. It is found with precisely this spatial relationship of the two segments that are complementary relative to the 3' end of RNA. And it is found with two additional characteristics. The first characteristic is that these base pairs typically are all, these nucleotides are typically all C's and G's. Thus, the base pairs that one forms of RNA-RNA, when you form an RNA hairpin, are CG base pairs, the strongest base pairs. That means that one's not really making a level energy landscape, but actually a downhill energy landscape because you're forming CG base pairs. And furthermore, this segment consists typically of exclusively or nearly exclusively UA base pairs, the weakest of all base pairs. So when you form this hairpin, you can drive the enzyme forward, exchanging strong base pairs for the weakest of all base pairs. And when you consider both CG and UA, making the energy landscape very severely downhill. So the idea is that termination, according to this model, by all known means of termination, MFD, Rho, an antisense oligo, or a hairpin, has the same explanation, same fundamental explanation, for translocation of the enzyme. Now, to say something about experiments, because Constantine did ask the question, one prediction is that if you put a roadblock on DNA ahead of polymerase, a protein like lacopressor that binds tightly to DNA, and positioned it so that that roadblock was right in front of polymerase, it should block termination by all of those mechanisms. In published work, this was done more than a decade ago by the Goldfarb lab in the case of termination at a hairpin sequence, and that is the observation. A roadblock, a bound protein ahead of polymerase, absolutely blocks termination. In unpublished work, this recently has been done by the Roberts lab at Cornell, for MFD, same effect, and for an antisense oligo, same effect. A roadblock ahead of the enzyme blocks termination. It is very difficult to imagine a model by which a roadblock ahead of the enzyme could block termination by these diverse termination signaling events, other than the simple model that the enzyme is moving forward. Another prediction is that when you move forward, you have to break DNA base pairs ahead. So for each step of forward translocation, you have to break a DNA base pair at the downstream end of the bubble. Therefore, one might suggest that if you covalently cross-link the two strands of DNA here, that according to this model, that would produce a barrier to termination because it would make it more difficult for the enzyme to translocate forward. This experiment has been done in unpublished work but has been presented at a meeting, again by the Roberts Laboratory, and that in fact is the observation, both with MFD or with an antisense oligo as the termination signal, namely covalent cross-linking of the two strands of DNA here inhibits termination. And so those experimental results are consistent with it, but by no means sufficient to demonstrate actual translocation. There is no direct observation to date of a physical forward translocation of the enzyme. No, it does. That's what I just finished saying. It does. It does. So that's the observation. Their initial observation was that it did not. And their new observation is that it does.
They still don't
But this is precisely what they're saying. It blocks termination. It's not an absolute block to termination. Unlike a roadblock, which is an absolute block to termination, this decreases the rate of termination. This is absolutely the result. Constantine misrepresents it to suggest otherwise. A covalent crosslink between these strands provides a barrier to termination. It's not an absolute barrier like a roadblock protein ahead. And so why might it not be an absolute barrier, but merely a kinetic barrier? Well, the proposal would be that covalently crosslinking these strands makes it more difficult for the enzyme to move forward. That is the prediction. That is the observation. That is the experimental result. However, it may still be possible with sufficient applied force from duplex formation here or from MFD and ATP hydrolysis to drive the enzyme forward even with the crosslink. So it's not an absolute block, but there most definitely is a decrease in termination. Most definitely is a decrease in release. That's right. Yes, there's a decrease in rate. I'm sorry, I didn't understand any of that. Could you say it again? Oh, you're... That's right. You're saying that simply sequences here and sequences here will affect translocational equilibration. That's right. That's right. No, it just the sequence of these duplexes most certainly affects the energy profile, but the only way you can make forward translocation over large numbers of base pairs actually become energetically favorable is to create new base pairs or apply an external energy source. Not large enough to do. Yeah, it's the AU base pair is not a zero free energy contribution. It's a low free energy contribution. So sequences that will do that yield pausing, but they're not sufficient. At least none has been observed to date to be sufficient to yield termination. That requires actually generating new base pairs, not merely changing the character of which base pairs are formed and broken. Okay. So this is a regulatory factor. You earlier asked if there were regulatory factors that impact on the different events in elongation. I said there were. One regulatory factor is a regulatory factor, or actually group of regulatory factors that are able to bind to sequence signals in the RNA, and when bound to those sequence signals in the RNA, change the termination properties of the enzyme. How could you change the termination properties of the enzyme? The actual mechanism by which any anti-terminator works is not known, but there are a number of ways you could change the termination properties. You could change the termination properties by making any change that makes forward translocation more difficult, according to this model, because termination would require forward translocation. You could also change the termination properties, decrease termination likelihood, by any change that makes occupancy of the plus one state, the productive state, more favorable. You could also change translocation properties with respect to hairpin sequences by changing the length of this tunnel. If you imagined an anti-terminator that was simply a donut that fits around this tunnel, making it a tunnel that accommodates 7 nucleotides rather than 5, it would completely erase the ability to recognize any hairpin terminator sequence, because now the position of the hairpin forming sequences relative to the 3' end in the opening of the tunnel would be incorrect. So there are a number of ways in principle you could build an anti-terminator. A very interesting subject will be to find out how some of the functional anti-terminators, such as N, which is the one that recognizes the signals you were talking about, in fact works. Again, could be working by inhibiting forward translocation, could be working by promoting translocation to step one and only to step one, or it could be working by changing the dimensions, the length of the RNA exit channel. It also could be working even simply sitting outside the RNA exit channel and ironing out hairpins as the hairpins are formed, preventing them from being formed. So there are a variety of ways it could work. It's not known for anyone how it does work. Yes, well, that's the decrease in the length of the hybrid is precisely what you observe if there were a forward translocation. There's no evidence whether it does or it does not. None whatsoever. If there were forward translocation, you have a decrease in the length of the hybrid, and that's precisely, according to this model, the basis of termination. I guess what Constantine is driving at is, what's the alternative? So you've all seen that forward translocation by, say, 9 steps would give you termination and would provide a single mechanism that explains all the known mechanisms of termination. How else could you have termination? What do other people believe, those who don't believe in forward translocation, which means most of the field? The alternative idea is that each of those signals produces a change in the properties of the protein that is transmitted to the active center conformationally and changes the property of the active center. So the proposal is that MFD up here tweaks the enzyme's rear end and a signal is sent through the body of the enzyme that changes the property of the active center yielding termination. Rho does that, a hairpin does that. There is in no case for any one of those possible pathways from MFD, from Rho, or from a hairpin, is there a proposed transmission mechanism? No one would even dare to suggest which residues are changing or how the signal is transmitted or what the nature of the signal is, but a vague statement of an allosteric change. I find that utterly unsatisfying. It also cannot explain the effect of a roadblock ahead as a block on termination, and it cannot explain the effect of a crosslink at this position in decreasing termination. Oh, I should also say one other unpublished result from the Roberts lab also presented at the same meeting, which is that if you build a synthetic template where this base and this base are not complementary to each other, so that they can't base pair, that strongly inhibits termination, almost a complete block to termination. The same is true for this base and this base, this base and this base. By a model of conformational transmission, there is no obvious reason that the identities of these base pairs, their complementarity or non-complementarity, should matter. By forward translocation, the complementarity of these is very important because these have to reanneal to form base pairs to forward translocate. Yes.
But this can happen without forward translocation. And if indeed the length of RNA DNA hybrid depends on the stability of the complex, you can lose the stability and thus terminate.
Okay, so what again Constantine is saying is that Constantine would say, well, you have a collection of observations that complementarity is required here, the absence of a roadblock is required here, the absence of cross-linking here is beneficial. There are multiple modes of inducing termination. It is known that the length of the hybrid decreases with termination. Those are the observations. There are two possible models to interpret these. One model says all of these are a function of forward translocation. It accounts for all data with one model, independent of the mechanism. The other model is to say that each terminator, a protein translocase on DNA, a protein translocase on RNA, an antisense oligo or a hairpin, has its own completely separate transmission mechanism that sends a signal to the active center that in addition somehow there causes the enzyme to terminate, and in addition somehow there causes the hybrid length to decrease with no specified mechanisms. Both of these are reasonable hypotheses. However, it should be obvious which one of these involves the smallest number of assumptions and which one of these and which one of these permits a test. The forward translocation model makes an unequivocal testable prediction. The enzyme must be observed to move forward. The other model makes no testable predictions. If this model is correct, we will know it by directly observing the enzyme moving forward. If the other model is correct, another 2 decades will pass without understanding termination.
I don't want to interfere with a good argument. However, because of the lateness of the hour, why don't you take 10 minutes to
summarize. Okay.
Forward translate.
Okay. 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 Well, I would just go on to say that in similar rationalization, just as this can explain termination, it also explains the 2 known classes of pausing, explains the tendency to enter into editing, and I think the ability to provide a mechanism for elongation that accounts for all data I'm aware of except the force-velocity relationships, which I want to ignore, that explains all information for termination, pausing, and editing, and does so by a simple testable model is desirable. But now we'll turn to current work. With respect to experimentation, the most important aspect with respect to elongation, indeed with respect to any of this, is to document that the enzyme, in fact, equilibrates between translocational states and moves forward under the conditions where it's proposed by this model, it moves forward. We have performed 1 experiment addressing this idea of translocational equilibration. It is a simple biochemical experiment. It's suggested by work done in the T7 RNA polymerase system by Rui Sousa and his co-workers. We performed this on E. coli RNA polymerase. The experiment is that we produced a transcription elongation complex. I'm going to draw it in extremely schematic fashion because of the time. So there's our bubble, and we produced a transcription elongation complex. There's the RNA product, and we had the last nucleotide of the RNA, the 3' nucleotide of the RNA, a nucleotide that cannot be extended further. It cannot be extended further because it's lacking the 3' hydroxyl onto which the next nucleotide would be added. And we've done this with 3 different chemical analogs of nucleotides that can be incorporated but not extended further. We then asked, using classical footprinting methods, these are enzymatic methods that probe the position of polymerase on DNA, where is polymerase when we make this complex and no nucleotide is present? When we do that, we find that the active central polymerase is partitioned over a series of positions corresponding to the 0 position, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, minus 4, minus 5. And we see smaller amounts, minus 6, minus 7, minus 8. So as predicted by an idea of a flat energy landscape from 0 and negative, we see the enzyme physically over those positions. We then add the next incoming nucleotide, the NTP, that would correspond to the next position on the DNA template, and repeat the footprinting experiment. When we repeat the footprinting experiment, the enzyme is exclusively in the plus 1 forward translocated position. So by enzymatic probing, by footprinting, the enzyme, in fact, in the absence of nucleotide, is able to sample a range of states. In the presence of nucleotide, samples only the forward translocated state. This shows unequivocally that for the template we used, and with the base analogs we used at the end of RNA, for that particular experimental system, subject to concerns about the method, the analytical method, the footprinting method, there is translocational equilibration in the absence of nucleotide. Addition of the nucleotide drives the enzyme forward. Because the primary concern with this experiment is it involves the enzymatic probing, which is subject to concerns of whether it may be influencing the footprinting, whether the footprinting itself may be influencing the equilibration. We therefore are now in the process of assessing this using a method that will directly assess translocation. In 2001, our laboratory reported a method where we could introduce a fluorescent probe into RNA polymerase and another fluorescent probe onto the DNA template, and then could measure the distance between those 2 fluorescent probes by fluorescence resonance energy transfer. And in this way, we can directly, in a unintrusive way, a non-invasive way, assess the distance between polymerase and the end of DNA, and thus the translocational register of polymerase. In our published work, we developed methods that did this with the probe on the initiation factor sigma. We want to do those experiments in an enzyme that doesn't have sigma in an elongation complex, and until recently, we did not have a probe on RNA polymerase core at the appropriate position, this being amazingly technically difficult to do. We've developed a new labeling chemistry that has allowed us now to put a fluorescent probe into RNA polymerase core at the extreme leading edge of polymerase, right on the nose of polymerase, and now we're prepared to do the same experiment by fluorescence and to test directly whether there is, in fact, a change in translocational equilibration when nucleotide is added. Another issue, should say termination there, yes, termination is to ask again the question, does the enzyme move forward during termination? We will address that using exactly the same method, fluorescent probe at the leading edge of polymerase, fluorescent probe on DNA, and then an antisense oligo. According to the model, an antisense oligo can move the enzyme forward a predictable number of steps. The number of steps that the enzyme will be moved forward depends on how long the antisense oligo is. And so we hope to ask, does an antisense oligo, in fact, hypertranslocate the enzyme 2, 3, 4, 5 steps in a predictable fashion and then give termination? Provided that experiment provides an interpretable answer, either this model will be wrong or this model will be right. Similar experiments for translocation in pausing and in editing. We also are interested in assessing cooperative effects. RNA polymerase generally does not start transcription, move to the end, and then a signal is sent so a new RNA polymerase begins. Very frequently inside the cell, the same transcriptional unit will have multiple RNA polymerase molecules. The presence of multiple RNA polymerase molecules restricts the range of translocational space that can be sampled by the enzyme. Same is true for ribosomes on translated RNA. We want to assess experimentally the effects on translocation of having cooperating RNA polymerase molecules and or ribosomes. In terms of quantitative simulation, which is what I thought probably the group would be most interested in, but I didn't get to it, the notion is that it is possible to predict with very high accuracy the thermodynamic stability of a nucleic acid duplex, DNA-DNA, DNA-RNA, or RNA-RNA, using nearest neighbor thermodynamic parameters. Thus, for all 16 possible base pair sequence combinations of DNA-DNA, RNA-DNA, and RNA-RNA, thermodynamic stabilities, delta G, delta S, have been measured, and it's been shown that you can predict the thermodynamic stability of an entire duplex from those individual nearest neighbor contributions with high accuracy. Therefore, it should be possible from a quantitative simulation of this energy landscape as a function of sequence, simply by reading for a position of the enzyme, the predicted thermodynamic stability of the DNA duplex ahead, the DNA duplex behind, the DNA-RNA hybrid, and structure in the RNA. We're working with Anirvan Sengupta. Anirvan has prepared an algorithm that allows us to, for any given sequence, for each position of RNA end on the sequence, to build the energy profile, to calculate the expected occupancy of each of the translocational microstates, to calculate the predicted probability of occupancy of the plus one functional microstate, and to predict the calculated probability of hypertranslocated or terminating microstates. It also, in principle, should be possible, if the ideas are correct, to start with such a simulation and also to begin to consider transition energies, model transition energies, to obtain information about kinetics of transitions. So only one more thing, which is in informatics, and then with such a simulation in place, it should be possible to take sequence, primary sequence, and from sequence, predict for each position the probability of occupancy of this site, and thus the probability of productive elongation, probability of termination of pausing. And so that covers everything.